8227. No matter if it's a car, truck, scooter, farm equipment, just about any kind of vehicle, we can take care of it. Just call 1-855-KPFT-CAR now or visit kpft.org. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston.
Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch signals Thursday, 8 p.m., and time for So What's Your Story. We're the only program originating in Houston devoted to live storytelling, and we're right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM Houston. I'm Warren Holloman. Tonight I'll be your host. Each week, Hank, Greg, Mary, Tatiana, and I, along with our extended, blended, and sometimes mended family of guest hosts and guest storytellers, each week we celebrate the power of story by bringing you remarkable tellers who take us on captivating journeys and then bring us safely home. Most of the time we feature individual storytellers, but that's only one way to tell a story. And there are all sorts of groups of people out there who collaborate to tell stories. I'm thinking of news organizations like newspapers and television news networks. I'm thinking of political organizations like political parties, special interest groups, lobbies. They all spin their narratives. I'm thinking of religious organizations like churches and synagogues and mosques. They all have stories to tell. And then there are arts organizations, theater companies, opera companies, film companies. Tonight, we're going to hear stories from two of my favorite Houston theater companies, Fourth Wall Theater and the Ensemble Theater. And these are stories you probably haven't heard before because they've never been performed in Houston, at least until now. Next month, Fourth Wall will present the Houston premiere of Collected Stories, a play by Donald Margulies. Collected Stories was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. It's been on Broadway, and it's coming to Houston in 3 weeks. But tonight, you're going to get a chance to hear a preview. The actors are here to tell one of the stories from Collected Stories. We'll hear those in the first half of the show. But this isn't the only prize-winning play making its debut in Houston next month. The Ensemble Theater is presenting Pipeline, a play that won the coveted Obie Award for playwright Dominique Morisseau. Pipeline was presented at New York's Lincoln Center in 2017, and just a couple of months ago, it was featured on PBS's Live from Lincoln Center. It's coming to the Ensemble next month, but we're going to give you a taste tonight. So here's what we'll do. In the first segment of the show, we'll feature Fourth Wall Theater, and then in the second segment, we'll feature the Ensemble and Pipeline. And if there's time in the end, we'll bring the two theater companies together for some improvisational conversation about theaters and storytelling, or what I like to refer to as collaborative or community storytelling. So, starting with Fourth Wall, I'm joined here in the studio tonight by Jennifer Dean, who's directing the show, and actors Kim Tobin and Reagan Elizabeth. Jennifer, Kim, and Reagan, welcome to So What's Your Story?
Thank you, Warren.
We're delighted you're here, and I'm going to start with you, Jennifer.
Okay.
As an actress, you've performed, and as a director, you've directed dozens of plays all around Houston. In fact, a couple of months ago, I saw a play you directed at AD Players, Tuesdays with Maury, and actually Kim and her husband were sitting just about five seats down from us, and it was just plain perfect.
Well, thank you.
And I talked with you about that, and I told you why I thought it was perfect. And now you're directing Collected Stories with Fourth Wall. I think a lot of us know how important a director's role is in producing a movie because we see all these things about movie directors. But
sure.
Directing a play is maybe a little less visible. Tell us, how does a director help tell a story?
Sure. You know, directing a play, for me personally, is a very collaborative process. It's very much about working with all of the designers to come up with the concept and the vision of the show and how you're going to tell that, so that from the moment the audience walks into the space, they are immersed in the world of the story that you're going to tell. And then it's the collaboration between the actors and just getting everybody on the same page so that we're all telling the same story, that we're all trying to get the same message out, communicating with each other so that the audience can really feel the effect of the playwright's words. So it's a very collaborative process. And I think sometimes with movies, it's a little bit different because the editing room, a lot of things happen sometimes even outside of the director's control. And I think within the theater, the director gets to be really immersed into the product that the audience sees on opening night and beyond.
It's a really cool concept. You're taking a story written by a playwright, and then you're helping actors tell that story, and you're kind of the midwife of the whole thing.
Right, right.
Now, Kim, you studied acting at one of the best drama departments in the U.S., which is just a few blocks from here, University of Houston. You went on to perform in plays and movies in New York City and L.A. before returning home.
Yes, that's
to
right.
To co-found with your husband, Philip Lael, the Fourth Wall Theater and the Kim Tobin Acting Studio. As the artistic director of Fourth Wall, what criteria are used in selecting the plays you want to present?
Well, there's quite a plethora of things you look at when you try to find a good play. And obviously, every theater company defines its own mission in terms of what kind of plays they do. But for us, one of the things that's very important is part of our mission is about an aesthetic of acting, which we work for that's very truthful and honest, and about a kind of reality-based work that feels like you're a fly on the wall in someone's home, or what you're watching allows you to suspend your disbelief as best as possible in our theater. So we look for a high quality of writing, very strong relationships, new plays even, too, that give you the opportunity to deal with timely issues. We also are it's very important for us that the dialogue and the structure of the play is very tight and very strong. We love Pulitzer finalist plays because the writing tends to be so powerful and so neatly woven. That's very important for us. But we also love classics, great plays that Houston's never seen. We always look for plays, too, that haven't been done here or that were overlooked in past years. We love Shakespeare. My husband's a big Shakespeare fan, so we try to bring one of those every few years. But it's about the writing and the relationships to us that really speak to us.
And what type of story is most compelling to you personally?
Oh, gosh. Oh, that's so hard. We just had a season where we did Jesus Hopped the A-Train, Pride and Prejudice, Rapture, Blister, Burn. They're all very different plays. But in all of these plays, I think what was so important to me was that the arcs of the plays have very strong beginnings, middle, and end, and there's a very big trajectory for me of change in the play. In other words, the play starts in one place and ends in something that for me is very different. In other words, you get a big journey and a big roller coaster ride for yourself, whether it's emotionally or just story-wise. That's really important to me. I'm not drawn to something that doesn't take you somewhere when you sit in that seat in the theater and have something cathartic happen as you watch these actors move through something in time and space in front of you in that seat.
Yeah. And I've been to your theater many times, and you really do feel like you're right on top of you're in the show. You're
good.
So close. It's so intimate. And so there's a lot of authenticity.
Good.
I like that. Now, Reagan Elizabeth, you grew up in Houston.
I did.
You studied in my home state of North Carolina.
I also did that.
North Carolina School of the Arts. You now live in Los Angeles, where you're a proud member of the Screen Actors Guild. Congratulations.
Thanks.
You've performed in Houston before at the Alley Theater.
Yes.
But this is your debut with Fourth Wall.
It is.
Now, my question, you're an actor, and that means you tell someone else's story. Like as storytellers, most of us tell our own stories. How do you prepare to tell somebody else's story?
obviously a lot goes into telling a story, and I think the goal is to tell the story truthfully and with integrity. And you have your basic actor's homework, which is research the play, and you research the playwright, you memorize your lines, one would hope. and, you know, you understand the relationships, and you identify what your character is doing and what their goals are, so that you understand the choices that they make and what drives them to the end of the play. But in a larger sense, I think it's really about vulnerability and leaving the parts of yourself at the door that will hinder finding truth for your character, and focusing all that you have on the person opposite you, because, you know, without your partner, without your person, you're just a human alone in a room achieving nothing, which is not interesting at all.
I like that. Kim, well, in just a moment, you and Kim are going to present this story. But first, Jen, as director, is there anything you'd like to say to set up the story? Anything our listeners need to know to better understand what we're about to hear?
Yeah, sure. The scene that Kim and Reagan are going to do is the second scene in the play. And Donald Marlees has written this really beautiful story about these two women. Kim plays Ruth Steiner, who is an acclaimed writer. She's written short stories and is now teaching in addition to writing. She teaches graduate students at a university in New York. And Lisa Morrison is one of her graduate students who is an aspiring writer and very much in awe of Ruth and her history and her work. And she, over the last 8 months, has impressed Ruth enough that she's now also become her personal assistant. And so she's helping take care of things around her house and keeping appointments. So this is the second scene in the play. They've only known each other for a short period of time, and you're starting to see how the relationship is taking shape. Ruth is coming back from a trip to Washington. And so this is kind of the scene from there. So I'm going to set up with some stage directions, so you'll hear me interject from time to time. May 1991. It's night. Lisa is puttering in Ruth's apartment, sorting through piles of books and papers, making them more orderly. We hear keys jingling at the front door. She excitedly goes to it.
Oh, hi. Wait, hold on a sec.
Lisa unlocks the door. Ruth enters, carrying an overnight bag.
What are you doing here so late?
I got your mail, and I watered your plants and stuff, and I decided to stick around and wait for you. Welcome home.
Thank you.
If you had told me what train you were catching, I would have met you at the station. You wouldn't have had to schlep so much.
That's all right. I took a cab.
So, how was Washington? I mean, I know how Washington was. You were so fabulous.
How do you know?
I saw you on C-SPAN.
Oh, God, you're kidding.
No, you were so great.
Really? How did I look?
You looked wonderful. You were poised and funny. They loved you.
Who?
The committee.
Oh, how could you tell? It was like talking to a convention of undertakers.
Oh, that was so funny when you said, "You're politicians, I'm a writer. We all have our crosses to bear." That was so great. You didn't seem nervous at all.
I wasn't.
I would have been a wreck.
It's all a show, all of it. I was just playing a part. A feisty older woman who cracks wise and gets away with saying just about anything. If she were alive today, Thelma Ritter would play me in the movies.
And what you said about a few inches of immortality on the library shelf? That was beautiful. God, when you talked about how you nearly gave up writing to work for that plumbing company, I didn't know that happened.
It didn't.
What do you mean?
It didn't happen.
But you said...
Yeah, I know.
You mean it isn't true?
There are elements of truth in it. I did do an office temp work job, and I was offered a full-time job at a plumbing supplies company, and I did get an NEA grant, but never for one moment did I seriously contemplate giving up writing.
Well, then,
why did I say that?
Why did you lie?
I didn't lie. I exaggerated.
Isn't that the same thing?
Okay, tell me. Would I have made a compelling case for the National Endowment before the House of Representatives if I had simply recounted the facts of my career? Absolutely not. I mean, where's the drama if there's nothing at stake? So, using the elements of truth, I spun a tale. I threw a crisis into the mix and allowed myself to be rescued at the 11th hour by the U.S. Cavalry. I exaggerated. I mean, what is art if not an exaggeration of the truth? Made a good story, didn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, God. I sorted everything. Mail that looked important I put here and everything else. And you got so many calls. So many people were expecting to leave a message on your machine, but then, of course, I would have to explain you don't have a machine, so then we would talk about that. Ed Doctorow called. Ed, I was talking to Ed. It was surreal. Don't worry, Professor. I tried not to embarrass you. I didn't gush too much, or at least I don't think I did. I didn't want him to think that you've got an idiot for an assistant or anything.
Ruth stashes some letters on her desk, but is disoriented by its lack of clutter.
What happened to the pile that was here?
Oh, I straightened up.
Oh, no. Why the hell did you do that?
Remember before you left, I asked if you'd like me to straighten up a little bit?
Straighten up, yes. Reorganize my life, no. I did not authorize you to reorganize my life.
I'm sorry, I didn't do anything.
I thought straighten up meant you were going to take a schmata and dust. Dusting is something this place could use. How am I supposed to find anything
now? Well, just ask me. What are you looking for?
Ask you? I don't want to ask you.
I'll tell you exactly where it is. I didn't throw anything out or anything. I just made neater piles.
I didn't want neater piles. I liked my piles the way I had them.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to.
There was a method to my madness, young lady, which served me well most of my life. Thank you very much.
I'm really, really sorry. I was only trying. I'm going to put everything back the way that it
was. Just leave it alone.
Sorry.
Oh, crap. You're not going to cry, are you?
No. Well, good night, Professor. I'm sorry for any inconvenience.
Oh, for God's sake. Lisa. Hey. Get over here.
What?
Thank you for sorting my mail and watering my plants.
You're welcome.
Let me write you a check.
No, I don't want a check.
Yes, let me. It was above and beyond the call of duty.
You don't get it, do you? Put that away, please. You know, all I want so much to please you, you know? And no matter what I do, it's wrong. I always seem to get your disapproval when it's the opposite that I want so badly. All these months, ever since school started, it has been both wonderful and excruciating working for you. I mean, to be so close to you and I admire you so much, but every day it's like a test. What faux pas will I make? What will I do that will annoy her today?
No.
Yes, yes, it's true. There's always something, some invisible line that I've crossed, or it's just something that I've bungled out of sheer panic.
Panic?
Yes. You intimidate me so much. When I show you something I've written, or even when I just talk to you, I think, what value could my words possibly have to her?
Oh, dear.
You are so, I mean, I knew you were difficult. You told me as much. But you really seem to take pride in being difficult, and that I just don't understand. I've said too much. Look, maybe I'm not cut out for this, you know? Maybe I'm not. My skin is just not thick enough. Oh, well.
Lisa struggles to remove Ruth's apartment key from her keychain and then sets it down.
I'm sorry I touched your things. I thought you would appreciate it. I'm sorry. If you're hungry, there's dinner in the fridge.
Oh?
It's nothing. I just made a little tuna niçoise, that's all. If you don't like it, it's all right. Just throw it out.
I'd love a salad.
Good.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. It's in the fridge, so whenever you...
That's awfully thoughtful of you.
I figured you'd come home late and everything. Well, enjoy it. Good night, Professor. I'll see you in class.
Why don't you join me?
Oh, no. I couldn't do that.
Why? Do you have other plans?
Not really.
Is there enough for two?
I suppose.
Then why don't you join me? I mean, you wouldn't leave me all alone, would you? I mean, not on the night of my Washington triumph. Hmm? Sit down.
Lisa hesitates, then approaches the table. Ruth picks up the key and hands it back to her and starts for the kitchen.
Oh, I can do that.
No, sit.
Ruth exits to the kitchen. Lisa puts the key back on her chain and sits at the table. Ruth returns with the food, with plates on a tray. She turns on the radio and then joins Lisa at the table.
Oh, this looks perfect.
They set the table together in silence. Ruth helps herself and then passes the bowl to Lisa.
Help yourself.
Lisa takes the bowl, serves herself, and the lights fade as they begin to enjoy their first meal together.
We're not supposed to clap on the radio. We don't always do what we're supposed to do. If you're just tuning in, you've just heard a story from the play Collected Stories, presented by Kim Tobin, Reagan Elizabeth, and Jennifer Dean of Fourth Wall Theater. Of all the plays out there, and why did you pick this one to present next month?
Oh, well, honestly, it's a kind of a longer story, but I'll try to wrap it up quickly. Mm-hmm. As a teacher, mm-hmm. I teach acting, of course, and I've been teaching for many years, a couple decades. And I have worked on that scene you just heard in my class for many, many years.
Ah.
Giving it out to students, because I often have older students and younger students in class. And I have waited to be old enough to play this role for a long time. Mm-hmm. I think it's a beautiful play. Mm-hmm. I think the relationship between the older woman and the younger woman is really beautiful and complicated, and I just think the writing is so beautiful. So it's kind of been a long time coming. Mm-hmm. And having my own theater, I have that luxury of being able to sometimes pick and choose the plays I think are particularly lovely.
Mm-hmm. And why that scene?
Well,
for tonight, I guess.
Well, for tonight, it's time is good. It's a good time limit for the show because it's complete in its time and beginning, middle, and end.
It has a nice arc.
It has a nice arc.
Yeah.
It gives you an introduction to them. It's a nice little window into the play and into their relationship.
But it doesn't give away too much either.
It doesn't give away too much of the play. Hopefully it makes you curious.
Oh, definitely.
Good.
And speaking of curious, one of the characters I understand who plays a pivotal role in the play, not so much in this part, but another part, is Delmore Schwartz.
Yes.
And I believe if we had been born a couple of years earlier, we would have known this man. He was a poet and a writer. Mm-hmm. But today, he's not so much talked about. Jen, could you tell his story to our listeners? But don't give away too much.
No, I won't. He's a really fascinating person, and he plays a very important role in the play, although he himself is not represented in a character. But Delmore Schwartz was born in 1913. His parents were Romanian Jews, and he grew up in Brooklyn, New York. And his parents divorced when he was around nine, and it really impacted him throughout the rest of his life. But he studied at Columbia and University of Wisconsin. He did graduate work at Harvard. So he was very studious, and he went on to become a pretty acclaimed poet and short story writer. He published his first book of short stories. His most famous work was called In Dreams Begin Responsibilities, and that is actually referenced in Collected Stories. That kind of set him, I mean, he really was put on the map, became very well known, very acclaimed. And he continued to write and to release other short stories and poems over the years. And many of them got positive response, but never quite to the extent of his early work. And through the course of his life, he became, you know, more and more tormented. He spent, and they reference this as well, many nights at the White Tavern, Horse Tavern in New York, which is still there, and talking to other artists and playwrights and poets and but he was tormented, and he became an alcoholic, and he actually died alone the last couple years of his life. He lived in a hotel, and he died alone, and it actually was a couple days before anybody discovered him, because he was kind of had become such a hermit. And it's some really interesting parallels between his life and some of the roles that you see in Collected Stories with Ruth, and then just some additional information. We don't want to give away too much
away.
You have to come see it.
Well, how can we do that? And when can we do that? And where?
Well, Kim?
Can I answer you, right?
Yes, well, it's begins
we open
May
17th.
May 17th at Fourth Wall Theater, which is at Spring Street Studios. It's part of the Washington Arts District, 1824 Spring Street. Of course, tickets are available at our website, which is fourthwalltheaterco.com, and fourth is the number four. And you can buy tickets now. It runs for 4 weeks beginning on the 17th, so you have lots of opportunities to see it. But it's really lovely, and you're right. Here's a little challenge for you. If you pick up one of our postcards anywhere around the city, the picture on the front of the postcard is a actual rendering of a imaginary story of Delmore Schwartz, and you have to come to the play to understand the story on the front of the postcard.
Oh, that's so cool. But what wasn't so cool was he had this all too typical life of an artist, where he was so tormented and died alone.
Yeah, there's some interesting. I'll just tease this a little bit. One of his students was Lou Reed, and he went on to, you know, be a part of the Velvet Underground, and actually wrote some music kind of in honor of Delmore Schwartz, and he didn't like any of it, and he refused to see him in his later years. Towards the last,
Delmore Schwartz refused to see Lou Reed
at, towards the end of his life. So, kind of an interesting change of their relationship. That teacher, student, mentor kind of relationship.
Right.
There's one of those in this play.
Teacher student.
Yeah. Right. And that keeps coming back in your personal work and life.
It does.
In this play, and in the person who is partly the inspiration for the play.
Right.
Well, Reagan and I also are
mentee. I'm also fairly certain I did this scene in Kim's class when I was like 17.
When she was about 17 and was my student before she went off to college. And now she's come back to actually act with the teacher. The teacher and the student are going to act together, which is very exciting.
It's intimidating.
But it's cool that you did the scene in her class and not in real life. You're just acting here, right?
Yes,
right.
Exactly. Yes.
But you do have to reach for something somewhere to pull out that anger and resentment, right?
Oh, sure, sure.
Maybe from other
teachers.
We
have a wonderful relationship.
And I will say that was actually one of the things in casting, to have that they already have a rapport with each other and that kind of teacher-student relationship. Mm-hmm. Is kind of a nice place to start. You're not having to jump into that not knowing the person. They already kind of have that. And so it adds a nice layer to their relationship in the show.
Cool. Well, that was Don Margulies' story. Uh-huh. Now I have a question about Kim Tobin's story.
Oh.
You were in Los Angeles performing in films and plays, and you were studying with these great teachers, but then you moved back home to Houston.
Yes, I moved to Houston from New York.
From New York.
Yeah, but I had been in both places, so correct.
And I know that your theater, like a good character in a play, has had some drama.
Sure.
You've had some ups and downs.
All right.
You've had a name change. You've had a near-death experience. Tell us the amazing story. Let's pretend that Fourth Wall Theater is like a person or, you know, an entity that we would tell a story about. Tell us the story of Fourth Wall Theater.
Well, I met my husband here. Mm-hmm. I had no intention of staying in the lovely, beautiful Houston, Texas, where I grew up. I grew up here. So I came back to finish my four-year degree at University of Houston. I had 2 years and then conservatory training. Mm-hmm. And I met my husband, Philip, and he loved it here. He wanted to stay. So I said, well, if we're going to stay here, we have to start a theater so that I have some control over my career. Mm-hmm. So we started Stark Naked Theater Company, mm-hmm. which was our first name and incarnation. And we had a little trouble with the name. Some people loved it. They were like, oh, my God, why'd you change that name? But we had a little issue with some people thinking we were actually naked.
Mm-hmm. In Houston.
In Houston. And also some corporate sponsors, which we've been working very hard on, having a little trouble putting their name on something that said Stark Naked. So we finally broke down and said, let's change the name. And we found Fourth Wall because, like you said earlier, the intimacy in our theater is very close. We love the idea of breaking the fourth wall, which is a theater term. Mm-hmm. That is the wall between the audience and the actors, which when you're in our theater, you feel very intimate.
There's no stage, per se.
Yes, and our acting, we feel like, brings you very close to us, so that was a good name for us. Yeah. So we did that, made that name change, and then a couple of years ago, well, I guess a year and a half ago, we were doing well. We had, financially, we were never in trouble, but Philip and I were running everything by ourselves, and part of our mission in our theater is to pay artists a living wage. We believe in that very wholeheartedly. And because we were working so hard and couldn't keep up with our growth, we decided that rather than cut artists' pay, we would shut our doors because we just couldn't do it any longer. And boy, when we did that, people just went crazy and said, you can't close this theater. We love this theater. And we finally had a really large donor who could actually help us pay some administrative staff that could support Philip and I's work. be put into place, and we survived the almost death of Fourth Wall Theater. So it's been terrific. We keep growing, and we've got some beautiful, wonderful staff members who believe in us that are helping us grow that donor base and keep us going so that this theater didn't have to leave Houston. So it's been great.
So you started with two things. What I hear is a relationship with Philip.
Yes, meeting my
husband.
That was
kind of important.
Yeah.
But also with a set of sort of values and a vision. Mm-hmm. And you reached a critical point where you were worried that you wouldn't be able to continue to support your values.
Correct.
Or you were being tempted to sort of become like the other theaters or shut down.
Well, I don't want to compare myself to other theaters because I don't know
fair.
What they do or don't do. But we just felt like rather than cut pay, we were going to shut our doors. So we just decided we'll just work at other places and do other things. And somebody else said, no, you won't. So we said, okay, as long as we can pay people and do what we love the way we feel like we can have integrity about it, we'll do it.
I think a lot of our listeners may go to theater and just think being an actor is a comfortable lifestyle.
Yeah. Well, that's movie stars. They read the headlines of you make $20 million a movie, or you know, and they don't understand that, you know, people in theater sometimes are making $200 a week. Mm-hmm. And I always use a comparison. I go, okay, well, go home and memorize one page of a book, and get up and perform it to your family with inflection and emotion, and see how hard that is. And then remember that people do that with 70 pages, and think about how hard that is. And they do all that before they even go to the rehearsal where they start getting paid. So they start doing that usually a month to 2 months before they get in the room, and they don't get paid for that time. And then they have to go home after the rehearsal, work, and then they have a job.
Right.
I mean, some theaters make enough money to support people, but most of the small theaters, if you go to small theater, don't pay enough for those people to live on. Mm-hmm. So that's a whole system of values and ideas that we're trying to change. So people can make more money and maybe take some time off their jobs, see their families, have some free time in the day to work on those lines, work on that blocking and that work they're doing so that they don't feel like they're exhausted all the time. They don't have time for their children. You know, we're trying to work on upping that exposure and ideas.
Yeah, it's incredible. I had a chance to get involved with one of the local theaters a few years ago. And so they had day jobs like me. And then around 6 o'clock, they show up and they start working on the set and things like costumes. And then around 8, they start the rehearsal.
Yeah.
This is more of a community theater.
Sure.
And we're going till at least 10:30. And I'm exhausted. You know, and then they say, oh, well, we haven't eaten yet. So we're going out to eat now.
Yeah.
And I said, well, oh, so you're not working at a day job. Oh yeah, I have to get up at 6:30 and go to work tomorrow morning.
Right.
So there's something about the theater though that seems to energize people and give you energy to do that.
Well, I think it's a calling. People feel like that experience of one of the last places that you still have a collective experience with other people, where you have an emotional connection and this cathartic experience. Is so rare that people are willing to sacrifice things in their life for it. And we don't think you should have to sacrifice as much as people sacrifice, and that we can find people willing to support that in a better way if they knew more information, if they understood it more clearly.
Reagan, what's your thoughts about that? Where do you get your energy from to do all this, other than being so young?
That does help.
I hear that apparently is going to change at some point in time. I will no longer be young, but I'm just going to ignore that now. I don't know. I just think theater and art in general is such a precious entity, and people who are a part of it just have this like unexplainable passion for it that you just sort of, it like gets you out of bed and you do love. It's like being in love for the first time. You like get up and you don't quite know why you have all of this energy, and you've been thinking about something all day long, and you just, it never stops fueling you, and you just keep wanting to give to it, and then it inevitably gives back to you.
Wow.
So
I think there's something, as you have probably discovered from this, doing this show, there is something about the power of a story that impacts people, and it in many cases can change people's lives. So we don't always know, but people come to the theater and you do occasionally meet someone after a show or get a letter and they tell you something happened in the theater and it changed me. And there is something about the power of story that continues to fuel those of us who do this because we believe in it. It's not just a hobby. It's not just we're going to play make-believe for a few hours. It's an opportunity to present something in a different way that allows people to have conversations and to see someone else's perspective and to open themselves up to something they may not have thought before. And there really is something very powerful about that. And as artists, at the core, we're storytellers, and we believe in the power of a story.
Mm-hmm.
Those are excellent answers. I often tell my wife, if we go Saturday night, I say, I don't have to go to church tomorrow. The story you told is so meaningful, so important, so inspirational, so life-changing. Well, I'm Warren Holloman, and this is So What's Your Story on 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. We're going to take a short break and take a look at our storytelling calendar. Tatiana?
Let's begin with our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild. They will host a story swap the fourth Tuesday of the month at Temple Emanuel across from Rice University. It's a great place to meet other storytellers, hear stories, or try out a story of your own in a relaxed, friendly atmosphere. And if you visit the Guild's website, you'll see in an archive of all of our previous shows, nearly 500 of them. Just click on the radio programs tab, and you'll be in story heaven. So, that's the Houston Storytellers Guild. As for the Moth, the next Houston Moth Story Slam will be Tuesday, May 21st, and the theme will be Mama Rules. Stories about everything from mother's love and maternal instincts to mama's boys and mommy dearest. As always, at Warehouse Live, and the show starts at 7:30. The Moth also has an incredible radio program on our sister public radio station, 88.7 KUHF. The Moth Radio Hour airs Saturdays at noon and features great moth stories from all over the world. And speaking of incredible programs, let's take a minute to talk about us. Hank will kick off our spring fun drive with a few storyteller newbies with tales about lingering memories they can't shake. All on So What's Your Story, only on KPFT 90.1 FM Houston.
That's next week's show.
Oh, and if you want to get a jump start on telling us how important it is to have storytelling in your life, go to www.kpft.org, then donations. And after you tell us how you're going to pay, be sure to scroll to So What's Your Story as a program you choose to support. And a reminder, whether it's next week's show or any of our shows, you don't need a radio to listen to us. You can listen to us online at www.kpft.org. And you can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube, finding more and more ways to bring you engaging stories from passionate storytellers. Warren?
During the first half of the show, we featured talented artists from Houston's Fourth Wall Theater. For the second half, we're featuring artists from another vital member of Houston's thriving theater community, the Ensemble Theater. And here tonight to represent the Ensemble is actress and playwright Crystal Ray. She hails from Chicago, but Houston is now her home.
Happily.
And she is a writer. She's written 2 one-woman shows, 1 one-man show, and several one-acts. She's in the process of expanding into, I guess, full-length plays. Crystal Ray, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So, you're an understudy in this upcoming production of Pipeline. What's an understudy? What do you do?
Well, quite frankly, if you're evil, you're hoping somebody gets sick so that you can take their place. If you're Nancy Kerrigan, you break their knee. I'm learning, and I've never been in
an understudy. Did you learn that in acting school?
I didn't. I learned that from the Olympics.
Okay.
Skating, 90s baby. I've not been an understudy before. This was my first time. I've done some mid-stage roles before. Understudy is a person who learns the role of somebody else who has the part, and you're the backup, right? So if they do become ill, God forbid, or something happens, the show must go on. Mm-hmm. And you jump in there and you keep the show going, and you perform the role. And they make a little speech, you know, so and so will be played by, you know, Crystal Ray. And if they bought the ticket for the other guy, there's a groan in the audience, right?
Uh-huh.
Right. And that's okay. What I'm learning in understudy is that I didn't know until I took this role is my job is to paint with the same colors that the artist before me painted with.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know that. The actress that was hired for the role, as it were, they have this palette of colors, these reds, these blues, these yellows they come into the space with, right? And the director is like, oh, I like what you did with that moment. That's what we're going to do with that beat, right? That moment, that space.
So you're there paying attention
during
rehearsal.
And I'm paying attention to how she painted.
Yeah.
And then my role is to authentically paint with the same colors and not change it into a comedy when it was supposed to be this tear-jerking... It's a different skill, I think, in a way, to paint authentically, to keep the same story that if you come on the night I do it and you came on the night that the person who has the role did it, you don't feel like you saw a completely different masterpiece. Mm-hmm. You feel as if there was continuity.
Yeah.
And that has been a really beautiful challenge. So I'm really grateful. That's a new muscle. And I'm like, come on, let's work out those muscles.
I've never heard it put that way. It's layers of empathy because you have to get inside the playwright's mind to present the character the way they wanted. But you're getting inside also the other actor's mind.
In a way.
That's cool. Yeah. So tell our listeners about Pipeline.
Oh, absolutely. Pipeline is about a woman named Nia, an inner city public high school teacher, committed to her students, desperate to give her only son opportunities that he'll never have. And in a controversial incident at his upstate private school that she sent him through, he gets threatened to be expelled. So it's almost the very thing she hoped wouldn't happen in the inner city school ends up happening to him at this private school. And so the conversation begins to be about, will she be able to reach him before the world, you know, kind of pulls him away from her, quite literally pipelined into the justice system. I'll quote Variety because they write well. Pipeline is an emotionally harrowing, ethically ambiguous drama that raises barbed questions about class, race, and parental duty and the state of American education. I mean, that's good writing, right?
Yeah,
that's Pipeline.
Yeah.
They said it better than I ever could.
And that really sets up the monologue because last year we did a show just featuring dramatic monologues as a sort of a different way of telling stories. And one of the most riveting monologues just happened to be a monologue from this show.
Mm-hmm.
It was presented by ensemble actor Curtis Vaughn, who I understand is in this show but playing a different role. And I'd like to play Curtis's monologue.
And then we'll chat about it.
Absolutely.
Okay. Wonderful.
This particular monologue is about the son, Omori. He's in high school, and his mother teaches in the inner city. In the community, and his dad doesn't want him to be a part of the inner city, so he pays to send him to a private school. His parents aren't together, so this is a particular monologue that he's speaking to his father, where he's speaking to his father.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I was sitting in class, listening to the lesson. Was going to be a silent observer. Was talking about Native Son. I'd woke up that day thinking about you. Hadn't seen or talked to you in weeks, but the check came on time. I woke up with that check in my hands and had a feeling about that. Like I didn't know what to say, but I wanted to say something to you. I called you, but you didn't answer. So I went to class. I'm sitting there listening to the class talk about Native Son, about the character Bigger Thomas and who he was and what led him to act out of rage. Teacher kept saying he was unleashed. I kept thinking, animal. And we discussing this Bigger Thomas, discussing the circumstances and where he comes from and this and that. Single mother, bad guy brought up. One of the students said he only had his mother. And I'm sitting there listening to this. On a day where I woke up with you on my mind, and I tried to call you, tell you I had this feeling about getting these checks, tell you I hadn't seen you in a minute, wondering where you'd been, but you didn't answer your phone. So I sat there, listening to single mother, poor, angry animal, Black Thomas, And when the teacher come asking me what I thought, it felt like he was saying something to me. Like he knew I was sitting there thinking about you. Feeling single mother, poor, angry animal, bigger Thomas-like. And he starts saying, Mr. Joseph, what made bigger Thomas do that to that girl? What were his social limitations? What made the animal in him explode? And he looking at me, but also through me. And I say, I don't want to talk about it. Because all I'm thinking about is you. And how I haven't talked to you in weeks. But I get this check on time. Like it's automated. Like the bank sends it to me. All I wanted to know is if you even mail it. Like, is it even personal? Or is it just robotic routine responsibility? And I'm thinking, who does that? What kind of man just sends checks and calls that fatherhood? And we talking bigger Thomas this and single mother and the limitations and animals exploding. And I do not call on me. I don't have an answer. And he keep pushing me and pushing me. And I stand up to walk out because I feel the room getting small and I'm becoming bigger Thomas. And even when I hate this part of the story, and the teacher get in my way, tells me to sit down, grabs me, like you do when you grab my arm trying to play daddy all of a sudden, when it's convenient for you. And I push him, throw him like he was a monkey hanging on my back, like he was you. And I'm wishing it was you. I'm wishing I could throw him again, pound his face into the ground, rip that check up and say void. But it wasn't you. It wasn't you I pushed. It was my teacher. But I wish it was you. I wished it was you so bad I had to pee. I almost peed on myself right there in front of the class. And I don't know if that is hate or a love or something else I was feeling. But I know why Bigger Thomas did what he did. And I hate that I know. But you, I hate more. You, I hate most of all.
Oh my.
Yeah, so.
Wow.
You know, this play really hits home for me because it's something that I can relate to. It's something that a lot of my friends that grew up in the inner city can relate to. Being in single parent households,
yeah.
You know, and angry and having this void, this hole in our heart that's not complete, you know, because yeah. that father figure wasn't there, you know. And even though this young man has his father in his life, he doesn't have yeah. him in his life. He has yeah. his money
yeah.
in his life,
yeah,
but he wants his father in his life. You know, he's already going, his father sent him to this private school so he can be afforded opportunities to make it outside of his community. And that's about as much as his father does, you right. know. So now you take this young man, you take him out of what's familiar to him. Mm-hmm. You put him in this environment where he feels that he's not appreciated. He's not loved, respected. And, you know, that's the explosion that happens.
Mm-hmm. Curtis, thank you.
So, Crystal Ray, this is such a powerful and riveting mm-hmm. monologue.
Yes.
And is the whole play like that?
It is. Yeah. There are funny moments. You always have these ups and downs and this sense of a really good ride and roller coaster, uh-huh. as it were. But it is thoughtful to the very last word of the play. Yeah.
Well, what are your thoughts about the message and meaning of the play? Maybe the relevance.
I kind of feel like Pipeline asks us to be like very vulnerable about mm-hmm. how we deal with our families and how we deal with the education system. And then it also asks us to be vigilant mm-hmm. about making things right. Mm-hmm. And doesn't just say there's a problem, but points us towards the point of making to endeavoring towards a solution. Mm-hmm. And I think hope is a personal like flag I'm waving in the air. Like there is hope. We can mm-hmm. solve it. If we want to.
Yeah.
And the play, I feel, ends that way. Yeah.
Right. And we've got all kinds of actors in this room, and just we're a little behind, but just a couple of comments, thoughts about the monologue you just heard. Anything you'd like to add?
I thought it was great. I thought I agree with what Crystal Ray said, and also with what was being said in the tape. You know, mm-hmm. I think it's really important thing to talk about. Children that don't have a father present in their home and what impact that has is not represented really well in theater as much as it should be too. But it's also about hope and how. The play definitely talks about hope. I've read the play, and mm-hmm. that's a really important thing to remember if you're going to go see the play. Yeah. It's not just a typical, you know, downer about homes that don't have a mm-hmm. full parental unit around. Mm-hmm. It's a really hopeful play about mm-hmm. a mother striving to give everything to her family, and it's a really good play. I encourage everybody to go see it.
I thought it was beautiful. I've never read this play, so I have absolutely no context whatsoever other than what he said. First of all, he's got a beautiful voice. I was really spellbound. I was, wow. Uh-huh. I was saying, most of the time with all of these points that he was hitting uh-huh. home. But I think, like, in terms of, like, being given a material object, money or otherwise, in place of love and affection, I think anybody can relate to that and has gone through that at some point in their life. And it seems very relevant.
Well, I've already bought my ticket.
Come through, bought a ticket.
I bought a season ticket, so I've got all the tickets. And I've actually got a ticket to the Fourth Wall show, too.
All right.
But there may be a listener or two out there who doesn't have a ticket.
Okay.
And how can they get a ticket, and when can they see it, and where, and all of that?
If you're a telephone person, you can call the box office at 713-520-0055.
713-520-0055,
or you can hit up the ensemble online and get your ticket from the website at ensemblehouston.com.
Cool. So, and where is your theater?
3535 Main Street.
If you're going by train, is there, which stop would you get out at?
It's actually the ensemble stop. It goes, boop, ensemble, HCC, and yeah. you in the right spot. Just get off.
That's great. Okay. Well, now as excited as I am about these plays, I know that other shows must go on too. So could you just give our listeners a taste of what's to come after these shows? Let's start with the ensemble.
Sure. Well, we service young performers also. So if you have a young performer that's interested in jumping in the limelight and they are driving you crazy in your living room, we are happy to help them and encourage them in their artistic formation. So session one starts in June 3rd, and July 1st is session two. And so we take kids from ages 6 to 17 and train them up. But the next on the main stage season roster is Josephine Baker. So come in your boas, bring your shimmy and your shake, and be ready to enjoy a fantastic musical.
I might come, but I probably won't wear the boa.
Come through. It's okay. We'll just have a boa on standby in case you change your mind.
Okay. And how about Fourth Wall?
Well, Collected Stories wraps up our season, but we just made our season announcement for next year. And those season ticket packages are on sale at last year's season ticket package prices. And we have, for the season next year, we have Glass Menagerie by Tennessee Williams. We have The Realistic Joneses by Will Eno, Between Riverside and Crazy by Stephen Adley Gurgis, and then we close with The Pavilion by Craig Wright. So I'm going to give you a little sneaky sneak here, too. And in The Pavilion next year by Craig Wright, you will see Jennifer Dean starring and me directing. So we're going to switch seats.
Role reversals.
That's so exciting.
Yeah.
And that's
so
a great segue to another role reversal, if I may talk about your husband and AD Players.
Oh, yeah. Yes, you may.
Actually, I'll let Jen do that.
Yeah. So opening at AD Players, same night that Collected Stories opens, is The God Committee. And this is a medical drama. We kind of say it's like ER meets 12 Angry Men. It's about the ethics committee at a hospital that has to decide who gets a heart when one becomes available. And they have about 90 minutes to make their decision. And so it's a real-time drama. It's a great show. And Philip Lael from Fourth Wall Theater is in that. So come see Philip.
So in case you haven't picked up on all the family systems here.
We're very connected in Houston.
That's Jen's day job is with AD Players.
Correct.
Marketing director.
Correct.
But at night, she works for Fourth Wall, directing
currently,
this play.
Yes.
Currently.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
And Philip's day job is with Fourth Wall.
Right.
But at night, he's going to be
sometimes works at AD Players.
Which is cool. And how about you, Reagan? What do you have coming up next?
After I finished the show, I had moved to Los Angeles about 3 months ago, so I'll just be hopping right back over there.
Auditioning? Is that what you
do? Yeah, that's the plan. I think I'll also be working at a casting agency as well, which is where I was interning last summer, and how I got my SAG card was they allowed me to audition for something that came through.
Oh, well,
so I'd love to start. Thanks. Yeah.
And Crystal Ray, you wear two hats. You're a writer and also an actor. Tell us about your one-woman show that is being performed, I think, in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, May 11th at City Life Church, 7120 Grand Boulevard. I'm telling the story of Moses's adoptive mom, Pharaoh's daughter, and what it means to adopt interracially and for it to go not quite as planned. And so Moses is kind of like an X-Men kid with full powers and talks to God, a God she doesn't know. And just her love for him just the same.
Yeah. Does Moses suppose his toes are roses?
Only if she sells seashells by the seashore.
Okay. You're just so young. That's a reference to theater long before you were born. I'm going to bring Hank and Tatiana in. Hank may know that reference.
Which reference is that?
Now, Moses supposed.
Oh, yeah. I mean, talk about a reason to part the Red Sea. I'll tell you, that would do it. That would do it. I love that. You know, actually, you're not going to believe this, but I wanted to get back to Kim. Delmore Schwartz, my grandmother just only had books at home. She was a Holocaust survivor, and one book that she had was In Dreams Begin Responsibilities. That was published in 1937, if you can believe that. And that's why that name rang a bell. You know, she was from Lithuania, and she was an incredible person. And, you know, ich kann, you know, ganz gut Yiddish. So when you use the word schmata, I love the play already.
Yes,
I mean, that's
all
it takes. That's all it takes.
That's terrific.
But I love this. I love this show, Warren. This was terrific. You know, stories always have the ability to form a common thread so that team members, actors, can stay so inspired. And I think that's what these two theaters do best, if that makes any sense.
I wholeheartedly agree. These are two of my favorite theaters, as I've said many times. And I'm going to be at both shows, and I encourage our listeners to go.
Absolutely.
And just remember that storytelling is diverse. You don't have to just have one guy on a stage at a moth show, say. It can be a theater telling a show as a community. Well, we're out of time. Tonight, our guests have taken us on journeys deep into the heart of human relationships. As promised, they've returned us safely home. One was a journey into a professional relationship that evolved, I think at least it was evolving toward a friendship. The other was a father-son relationship that began recalibrating when the son became a man and confronted his father, basically. Jen, Kim, Reagan, and Crystal Ray. Thank you for being with us on So What's Your Story?
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Well, don't you dare move, because Lars is up next with a sweet mix of singer-songwriters on the Tennyson tapes. Make 90.1 a part of every day, and while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story, and treasure what you hear. You keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Warren Holloman, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we want you to never forget that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace. Thank you.
If you decided to donate your birthday to KPFT this year, thank you. If your special day hasn't yet arrived, consider donating your birthday to KPFT. Here's how it works. Facebook sends you a prompt before your birthday asking if you'd like to donate your birthday to a nonprofit. Select KPFT as your organization of choice. Then,